impulses are being redirected. We are living in an artificially induced state of consciousness that resembles sleep.
Descending now to our secret headquarters at the center of the Earth.
Precognitive
Dissonance!
Hello, hello? Testing 1, 2, 3?
The theme song echoes through the abandoned caverns of the Darrows.
Oh, boy. Okay. So welcome. Welcome once again to Precognitive Dissonance. I'm Smiles Lewis.
I'm Craig York, and our guest tonight is the lovable and affable Nick Redfern.
Hi,
Nick.
Hey, man.
You are lovable and affable, aren't you, Nick?
Depends on the mood. I mean, sometimes.
Well, you know, I mean, the photo on the header at UFO Mystic is a little intense, but, you know, it's an intense subject.
That's right.
An Arab's whole life is intense. Ba-dum-boops. Okay, that was really awful. Welcome again, live via Anomaly Radio here in the, not the Deep South. It's deep enough, though.
Well, it's sort of off to the side of the Deep South. I mean, that's properly Mississippi, Georgia, and that other squarish state further east.
All points in between.
Yeah. South Carolina, too. And Northern Florida.
Well, thank you, everybody, for joining us. It's great to be back. It's been about a week or so, right? At least.
2 weeks. 2 weeks since our last broadcast. Life will intervene, as it were. But we've got a show for you tonight. And I'm a little bit loud, actually, Miles. Much better. Thank you. Not that I ever tire of the sound of my own voice, you understand, but...
Oh, now I can hear everything better. Yeah. Oh, you, engineer, pointing to vacant air. Twiddle those knobs. So it's been quite some time since we had Nick on the broadcast, and that's not due to a lack of things for him to talk about or lack of our wanting him to be here, but he's a man about town and a man about the world and has been making the rounds again at various UFO-related events and, as always, reporting back to the layperson and us weird freak anomalist.
Giving you something to think really hard about.
So, Nick, what has been occupying your time?
Well, a couple of things, really. One is Ryan Wood's annual UFO Crash Retrieval Conference, which is held in Las Vegas every November, which I've been fortunate to attend and speak at for the last 6 years. That took place 3 weeks ago, and I guess the other big thing, which is on a completely different subject that I've been following more than anything else, is the Center for 14 Zoology's expedition to Guyana looking for mysterious animals. And I've just done a big interview with Richard Freeman, who's the zoological director of the group, posted at my blog today, which is basically following the team when they went out there and the sort of weird animals and mysterious creatures they heard tell of while they were in the savannah and the jungles of Guyana. So sort of two broadly, I guess, completely different topics, but I guess of interest to people who listen to the show.
Well, as I'm always apt to point out, so many cryptozoologists don't want to talk about UFOs and so many UFO people don't want to talk about Bigfoot.
It looks like there's something in the woods has a new look to it.
Yeah, I changed the design and the color a little bit. I got bored, and one night I was doing nothing else and thought I'll just mess around with it a bit.
And you've launched a couple of new blogs devoted to the different specific areas of each of your books, correct?
Yeah, I've got one. I've done 10 books altogether, of which the first three I did back in England, which were 10, 9, and 8 years ago. They're out of print now. But the ones I've done over here are all still in print. So what I did, I've got obviously the Something in the Woods blog, which is for the three cryptozoology books I've written. But then for the other books, Celebrity Secrets, Strange Secrets, Body Snatchers, and On the Trail of the Saucer Spies, I decided to set up separate blogs for them. And there was the reason why I did that, somebody asked me this the other day, was because, you know, if you're just writing about UFOs, then I don't see any harm or any problem with just having one blog. But, you know, when you're writing about everything from celebrity secret files to UFOs to Bigfoot to Loch Ness Monster, etc., yes, there's a lot of people that take interest in all these subjects, but then again, there's a lot of people who don't. And, you know, I figured that if I set up a UFO blog, there's going to be a certain percentage who go there that aren't necessarily going to be that interested in reading the latest about Bigfoot or the Loch Ness Monster or the Yeti, and vice versa. So I figured the thing to do would be perhaps to have sort of dedicated blogs which are completely separate, and then for those that are interested in learning what the FBI knew about Marilyn Monroe, or whoever's interested in learning about the Chupacabras or Area 51, they can go to those relative areas and not get bogged down with things that maybe, you know, aren't necessarily of direct interest to them.
And the Something in the Woods, there's Something in the Woods blog is monsterusa.blogspot.com.
That's correct. Yeah.
And what are some of the others?
Well, there's desertdarkness.blogspot.com, and that's for body snatchers.
What's that called?
Darkness in the Desert.
Darkness in the Desert.
Yeah, and that's,
okay,
that's for the book Body Snatchers. And then the saucerspies.blogspot.com, which is for On the Trail of the Saucer Spies. And then the strangest secrets, .blogspot.com for strange secrets. So I'm having a hard time remembering the name, the addresses of them all then.
Maybe trivial, but you find yourself going to them kind of on schedule, or do you just hop about?
No, I kind of hop about. I mean, a lot of it is dependent on what stories are out there. I mean, for example, today I posted a big interview with Richard Freeman, as I mentioned, to the Something in the Woods. And, I mean, I started on that this morning and had to sort of transcribe the audio cassette and then, you know, make sure it was all right, put all my extra comments in, then put it on the blog, which took a couple of hours altogether, I guess, to get that done. And so, you know, that didn't give me much time to do the other stuff, so I've neglected some of the other blogs a bit today. But I always try and do, out of the five or six blogs I've got, I try and do sort of post to at least two of them each day, and then, you know, if I miss one the next day, then I'll do that one the day after. So,
I've been excited to see that the Crypto 40N organizations continue doing the video, CFZ TV, reporting on just these topics, the Guiana expedition and other cryptid issues around the world.
Yeah, I mean, this is obviously in many ways born out of things like YouTube. I mean, John Downs, who runs the Centre for 40N Zoology in England, realised the potential of outlets like YouTube. And so what John's done, he puts together this monthly, I guess for want of a better term, magazine, but instead of it being a published magazine or even like an online journal, it's actually like a video magazine which kind of features John introducing it, usually in some old English pub somewhere or other, and then with a pint in hand. And then, you know, instead of somebody turning the pages and going to this feature or that feature, the online magazine, I suppose, goes to different video snippets on whatever the organization's up to, as you said, whether it's a trip to Guyana or something they're doing in England, or, you know, things like that. So I think it's a good way of doing it. It's kind of like snappy and to the point, and it's got like cool background music, and, you know, it jumps from one subject to another. And
his great voice narrating the whole thing.
Oh, yeah, John's got like this typically upper-class English accent, and you know, he comes across like a cross between, I guess, Sherlock Holmes and Indiana Jones or something like that. And I think it's a good, you know, cool little outlet he's put together for people who just want to, you know, sit in front of the computer and not have to wade through a magazine or scroll the net. They can just log on once a month and see what the group's been up to in the previous 4 weeks.
Yep, and this new technology allowing everybody to be their own TV channel.
Yeah, exactly.
It's vodcasting, you know, video podcasting for videos. It's great.
Yeah, exactly.
And it just gets better and better. So you've been reporting on that interview?
Yeah, basically what happened was that over the course of about the last year, 18 months, the Centre for 40N Zoology has been doing a lot of digging into stories of weird animals that were coming out of Guyana. And this is a whole range of weird things, some more down-to-earth than others. For example, in the, I guess, more down-to-earth category, a lot of reports of very, very large anacondas, not in the range of that is generally ascribed to large anacondas, sort of 20, 25 feet, but literally creatures sort of 40 to 50 feet long with bodies the size of oil drums, if you like, huge, you know, literally monstrous snakes. And a lot of these were coming from a particular mountain range in Guyana, which is sort of very, very inaccessible and difficult to get to. But on top of that, there are also sort of, I guess, more mystifying reports. The natives there have stories and legends of a creature that's become known as the Didi, which is D-I-D-I. And this has been variously described as like anything from like a giant sloth, which don't exist anymore, presumably. They supposedly became extinct many, many years ago. Or some people described it as being more like a classic Bigfoot-type creature. And then there's this other creature, which actually doesn't have a name, but it's been described as like a small pygmy-like creature with a brownish skin. And this has been, if you look at the report, it sounds very much like some sort of very ancient surviving relic hominid, a human, you know, like from the Stone Age or something like that. So the CFCs wanted to get out there for a long time and basically, you know, see what's going on and examine the evidence and really do an on-site investigation, because I think cryptozoology is one of these areas that perhaps more than any other, it's one that requires on-site studies. You know, you have to get out there. You're not going to find the answer to Bigfoot just by sitting in front of the computer. Yes, you can find a lot of information, but, you know, there's no real alternative, I don't think, to actually getting out there and getting your hands dirty, so to speak. And so John and the other guys at the CFC, they have been liaising with Capcom, the computer company, who put out this Monster Hunter video game. And Capcom decided, you know, or approached them and said, you know, would you be interested in us sponsoring you? And, you know, in terms of publicity, et cetera, it works for both the CFC and Capcom. And so what happened was that they funded the CFC expedition out there in terms of, you know, getting the guys out, et cetera, et cetera. And it was basically a five-person team. There was Richard, Dr. Chris Clark, who's been on several expeditions with Richard, Paul Rose, who's an English author, who's actually writing a book about the Center for 14 Zoology, like a fly-on-the-wall documentary-type book. Lisa Dowley, who works with the organization as well, and John Hare also works with them. And the plan was to go out for a couple of weeks and various people who they'd already hooked up with, guides, etc., in Guyana, had already arranged for them to speak with various witnesses. He found people for them to speak with, eyewitnesses or people who, you know, stories had been passed down their families who could kind of add some details and stories into with respect to some of these weird creatures that we've seen. So that was basically the plan, you know, to go out there and really go out into the savannah and into the mountains and see what they could find out. So, you know, if you want me to talk about a few of those discoveries, I can.
Yeah, please. I haven't had time to look at the latest postings, but I did see some of the photographs that got put up, and awful lot of photographs.
Yeah.
There was one fairly impressive image of an anaconda track.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I gather they had at least some modest success in that area.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that very large anacondas do inhabit Guyana. That, I mean, that's a fact. But, you know, we're talking about things sort of 15, 20 feet long. Mm. The bigger animals were actually seen in or been reported primarily from a place called Corona Falls, which is like a large waterfall area in the mountains. Now, unfortunately, this was the one place where the group didn't get to go to, and it was through no fault of their own. It was literally the fact that the temperature was something like, literally about 120 degrees. I mean, just what, you know, in your face wall of heat, 24 hours a day, and practically no cover canopy because, you know, they're out in the savannah for most of the time. Yeah. And Richard actually fainted once, and Paul fainted as well with heat stroke. You know, coming from England, of course, where everybody's white and pasty, and it's probably the worst place you could go to. And unfortunately, the intense heat had dried out the main river that goes to the mountains to such an extent that it just wasn't even feasible to try and launch a boat on the river. You know, you just graze the boat on the bottom of the water before you've gone 10 feet.
Mm-hmm.
So they weren't able to get there, but they were able to speak to various tribes and natives that were fully aware of these sort of great snakes. And one of the most interesting stories dated back to the 1950s, when there were a group of guys actually on horseback, and they were scouting around the area doing some hunting and decided to stop for the night near the river itself and tied the horses up and made camp, etc., and were woken up in the middle of the night by what sounded like this loud splashing noise coming from the river. And on top of that, kind of more ominously, there was this sort of heavy breathing noise, and sounded like something was shuffling along, something heavy shuffling along through the savannah. And the horses were basically going wild and jumping around, and some of the guys shot guns in the direction of where this strange noise was coming from. They released the horses, and everybody luckily got out of the area. Now, what's interesting about this particular stretch of river where they were camping is that it actually has a lot of dragon legends attached to it, you know, sort of giant reptiles and amphibious-type creatures. Now, Richard, having interviewed one of the people who was aware of this story, he's pretty convinced that these so-called dragon legends are probably based on reports of giant anacondas. He doesn't necessarily think, you know, there's a giant snake and a giant dragon of some sort there, you know, whatever sort. I mean, people have said a monitor lizard, but there actually aren't any monitor lizards of any sort in South America.
Yeah, but, yeah, some kind of outsized caiman or crocodile.
Yeah, exactly.
Logical choice.
Yes. Now, it could be something like that, which, you know, I guess would look like a dragon to somebody who's sort of only aware of, you know, the legend, etc. Yeah,
or...
But, I mean, that particular case, Richard was particularly impressed by that one, and they came across several others like that. Several cases where in the vicinity of these particular waterfalls there was a large cave system where supposedly these large snakes live, and there were reports of people being dragged into them and, you know, never being seen again. And given that the fact that we do know that there are indeed, or, you know, there have been very, very large snakes of this type in Guyana, it's not, you know, beyond the realms of possibility that there could be even larger ones, you know, hidden in certain pockets there that have thrived and just, you know, grown and grown and grown. But,
wow.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I guess that's sort of the background, if you like, on the giant snakes. But, I mean, some of these other creatures are far stranger. For example, this one called the Didi. Before Richard went out there, he was fairly convinced, as I said earlier, that what this creature was probably distorted either memories, you know, folkloric memories, or possibly even modern-day sightings of giant ground sloths which had survived extinction. I mean, the giant ground sloth is, you know, became extinct years ago, you know, millennia ago, and it was a huge creature. I mean, were it to stand upright, it would be like 20 feet high. You know, try and imagine a 20-foot tall grizzly bear with large claws and very, very vicious. That's what the giant ground sloth was like. Now, Richard postulated that because people were saying the Didi had claws, that maybe they were seeing a surviving relic, but they were saying this thing was maybe sort of 7-8 feet tall. And, you know, over the millennia, if you like, maybe the surviving version of it had become scaled down and, you know, just a smaller version. That's not impossible. But when they got out there, all the people Richard spoke to, none of them described these claws. The claws were more ingrained in the old folklore and legends, but people in the last 100 years who'd seen it described it as not being like a bear or a sloth-like creature with claws, but looking very, very much like a man-like creature but covered in hair. Very, very similar to the Yeti or the Bigfoot. Now, one of the other reasons that leads Richard to think that this is some sort of relic human, or, you know, something along the lines of the Yeti, is the fact that they uncovered a number of stories in completely different parts of Guyana from some of the more remote tribes of where supposedly the Didi had, I guess for want of a better term, raided their villages at night and kidnapped children. And there are a number of stories like this that apply to Bigfoot literature as well. You know, they seem to have a fascination with people and watch them, and, you know, and there are reports of them being kidnapped even.
And I was just recalling, at my day job with the State Talking Book Program, we record books for the blind. We recorded a book about called Captured, that's about kids that were abducted by the Native Americans from, you know, the settler communities, and how after a certain period of time, if the kids were with them for over a certain length of time, they really were no longer wanting to go back. And
yeah, they became socialized to the tribe. It's, you know, probably some corollary to the Stockholm syndrome.
Yeah.
Something else tickling in my mind. It'll come back to me. But
so the Dai turn out to be these child abducting.
Yeah, they seem to be more like an ape man. I won't say, you know, something that's like a giant ape. It wasn't so much like Gigantopithecus or something like that. We're talking more about like a very primitive man. Like a hair-covered, man-like creature. Now, one of the other reasons why that may be the case, and this again ties in with some of the Russian reports of creatures like the Almas, is that there were stories, they uncovered, I think, two stories, where supposedly female human women had, you know, given birth to like a half-breed type creature. You know, there are one or two very famous stories from the former Soviet Union that parallel very, very closely the Guyana tales.
It occurs to me that's something else that dovetails with some of the Central American reports of ABMs. And that's them stealing into villages at night or isolated farms and stealing women as well.
Yes, exactly. And apparently in this one case that Richard uncovered, the woman supposedly gave birth to, you know, like a half-breed creature. And if that was the case, you know, that would have to be some sort of human being. There's, you know, it couldn't happen with like a monkey or something like that. It's just not feasible with the, you know, the genetic structures. So it would have to be some sort of, you know, type of human being. But if this story is true, it's kind of a grisly one, because supposedly some hunters further down the line, a couple of years later, actually tracked down from the same village, tracked down where this woman was being held, and they managed to get her to safety, and she jumped in a canoe and made off. But the story was that as they were leaving, the creature was so enraged that it supposedly tore the half-breed child to pieces in like anger. And so it wasn't like a particularly good story. But I mean, you know, some of these stories, we might say that they're like local folklore or whatever. But then again, it's interesting that, you know, nations completely separate to each other with no contact, but where there are legends of these hairy creatures, you know, Russia, Siberia, Guyana, they all have these same stories of these hairy creatures taking a deep interest in human beings and kidnapping them and spying on them, etc. And
What other anomalous entities do we know that do that, that have in a completely different context?
Yeah, exactly.
Several different other contexts.
So, I mean, I think, you know, that this is all evidence, at least, that suggests we should look further into these stories. And, I mean, one of the things that Richard came to appreciate was that purely because of the sheer nature of the country, the heat, the inaccessibility of some of the places, a lot of people from, you know, for want of a better term, the civilized world, they've actually have never been there. You know, they're areas that are simply unexplored, because nobody's really had any need to go there other than people that are looking for these weird creatures. And, you know, very often the people who want to do that don't necessarily have the funding or abilities to go there anyway. So a lot of these mountain ranges and savanna lands, you know, as the tribesmen said, they just don't see people for, you know, decades and decades from outside of their own communities visiting. So, you know, if something is there, it's not at all strange to understand how and why it hasn't been discovered, particularly if it's kind of stealthy in its activities as well. So.
Wow. As usual, it's all very, very fascinating to me. So many different areas to dive into.
And I'll just remind our listeners that the Center for Fortean Zoology is a public concern. You can help it out by donating. So if you've got a couple of extra bucks, well, that's one step closer to the next expedition.
And you can support Nick by getting his books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And congratulations to you and Greg for a year of blogging over at UFOmystic.com.
Yeah, I couldn't believe that. I didn't even notice until Greg posted the cake, and then I realized I hadn't been keeping watch, unfortunately.
And as usual, there's been a load of great stuff to read about and discuss over there about UFOs. I was very pleased with your tip-off to folks about the vanishing Fortean and UFO FBI files.
Yeah, that's kind of weird. I mean, one of the things that I've done just recently, as I mentioned earlier, set up this blog for my Strange Secrets book. And Strange Secrets basically is a study of government files on just general weird phenomena where, you know, government agencies have looked into things like the Loch Ness Monster, ESP, spontaneous combustion, etc., etc. And what I was going to do was do a posting each day titled, you know, Weird Files Part 1, Part 2, and every day alert the readers to, you know, where they can find government files online on strange phenomena. And I knew that the FBI declassified a wealth of files on things like spontaneous combustion, various UFO-related files. And so, you know, I went to the site to grab the link, and then I could just post it to the blog, only to find that various files that had been declassified and that the FBI previously, and actually for several years, had posted online as PDF documents where anyone was free to download them, they've started to withdraw them. Now, what's interesting, it's not a case that they're withdrawing all the files, you know, on people like Frank Sinatra or Marilyn Monroe. So far, as far as I can tell, it just seems to be the Fortean-related files. And so far, they've withdrawn the PDF collection on spontaneous combustion. They've withdrawn the file on Philip Corso, who co-wrote the book The Day After Roswell, Colonel Corso. They've also withdrawn their surveillance file on Silas Newton, who was a fairly notorious character involved in the Aztec New Mexico UFO crash of 1948. And that file talks about how Newton supposedly had heard this story about this crash in the desert, and, you know, he was alluding to having secret information on it and contacts within the government. So that file's gone. And I think there's one or two more where I think the name has been deleted as well in terms of the UFO subject, but there are also a lot of other Fortean-related files that have been withdrawn as well. For example, the file on Wilhelm Reich and all his cloud-busting activities, that's gone. That's like an 800-page file. That's completely disappeared. All you've got now is a name check. He's still listed under the R section for Reich, but when you click on it, there's nothing there. The file on Nikola Tesla, that's gone. Now, one of the things I did mention to somebody who asked me the question was, you know, to what extent does that mean the files are available? Now, there are actually two approaches. One is that this is the weird thing. You can still request these same files from the FBI. They haven't withdrawn the files. What they've done is just taken them off their website. Now, if you write to the FBI and request these files, you can still get them, but because some of them run into, you know, the high hundreds in terms of page count, you may well have to pay to get copies. Now, the other way, fortunately, is, you know, there are people on the internet who downloaded those files a long time ago before they were deleted, like I did, and some of these people have set up their own sites where you can also download them as PDFs, which is a good thing. You know, so if you go online, people like Paperless Archives, you know, you can get the collections from them, some of them at least. And, you know, there are a lot of these sites online, people like John Greenwald's Black Vault, where, you know, we're lucky enough that some people have posted them. But if, you know, if those people hadn't done that, it would make our job incredibly more difficult. And
It's no secret that this is the most secretive administration ever.
Yeah.
I mean, there's been several nonprofit groups who have studied the declassification, reclassification that's been going on under this current American administration.
Oh, yeah.
And over and over again, they see more things declared secret than ever before from their inception, as well as the retroactive determination of things, you know, things that were made public being redone, remade secret, and that's would be my first question. It sounds like you're saying that no, these haven't actually been reclassified. Mm. It's just that they've been withdrawn from easy access.
Exactly, and I think in some ways this is more disturbing because it's almost like, you know, history is being made invisible to us, or it's being taken away. And, you know, for a lot of people, the mere fact of withdrawing these files, by definition, in some ways, they are reclassifying them, because if people don't know about the files, they're not going to find out about them or read about them, so they might as well just be classified. And I think this is kind of disturbing, you know, this idea that we've been granted access to this material, only then to find it slowly and quietly withdrawn from public view. And I know the same thing has happened at the National Archives, that certain materials being pulled that was originally placed into the public domain. I mean, I'll give you a clear example. A lot of the files on the so-called human radiation experiment scandal of the 1990s that were declassified, actually back in the 90s, you know, there was this huge inquiry to determine to what extent human beings are being unwittingly or wittingly used without their permission mm-hmm. in radiation experiments. A lot of them were placed online at the, I forget the name of it, it was, you know, the human experimentation website that was set up by the Department of Energy.
Yeah.
Practically all those files are now gone. They're no longer online. Now, again, you can go to certain archives and review them, but you have to know what you're looking for. You know, the old days of going to where they were all archived online as PDFs, and, you know, there was a search engine you could search on every single term. That no longer exists, unfortunately. And when you go to the site, at least as late as 6 months ago, there was a message posted saying something like, in the wake of 9/11, you know, our services and access to files are being reviewed, and when a decision has been made, you know, at some point in the future, they may be back online, or something along those lines anyway.
In the case of the FBI files, for example, has the Bureau offered any kind of rationale for these removals? Has anybody approached them about
it? I'll be perfectly honest with you, Craig. I haven't actually asked them. I mean, this has literally only come to my attention, what is it, today, Tuesday? I think Monday.
Okay.
So, you know, and I think I posted the story Tuesday. So, I mean, it may well be the case that somebody's, you know, phoned them up and asked the question. I mean, that there could be an innocent explanation. Somebody said, is it possible that, you know, with the new the new X-Files movie being filmed next month as film starting, is it possible the FBI is concerned loads of people are going to go to the site and download the files
servers
and crash the system? You know, I mean, that's, well, you know, if there's a billion X-Files fans all downloading UFO files and cattle mutilation files, I mean, you know, Miles, out of the question, I don't know.
You know, Miles and I have both seen government computers, and I know, for example, 7-8 years ago, we still had great big tape drives, you know, like something out of a 60s science fiction film running. Uh-huh. So, yeah.
Well, you do a parapolitical blog over at Night of the Living Jackboots, Nick Redfern, conspiracy.blogspot.com. And so you know, you're definitely aware of the nefarious misdeeds of the power structure.
Yep.
And, of course, in the news in the last few months has been the adventure of Wikiscanner that detects edits made at things like places like Wikipedia, where anybody can edit this, that, or the other. And what they're finding is, you know, lo and behold, the political powers that be and corporations and activist groups are going in and rewriting history. Mm-hmm. And just this past week, there's been several things coming out about different Republican organizations changing data about the lack of weapons of mass destruction, the entries for that on Wikipedia, as well as information about Guantanamo, and very interesting times we are living in.
Yeah, and I think, unfortunately, in one respect, although the Internet's a great tool, when I think today in today's world there's a huge reliance on getting all the news from the Internet, you know, you're only getting a story that's as accurate as what's written on the Internet. And, you know, when people start rewriting things, and people who may not be as well-versed as yourselves in, you know, knowing what's going on, they just assume that's fact because it's on the Internet. So, you know, I think that's something to be aware of as well, is the ability of, you know, whoever to so easily change history and have people just buy the story. So.
Well, it's one of those, you know, even being aware that there are a tremendous number of news sources out there, I still tend to drift back to the Economist website every couple of weeks, and, you know, that's where I get my world and national news.
Yeah.
I'll glance at the local newspaper in the studio, but, I think I stopped watching network news, except in passing, 8-10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's one of those, variety can almost overwhelm you sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But I think the most intriguing thing about this withdrawal of files is, as I said earlier, as far as I can tell at least, the ones that have been withdrawn are 14 files. Now, you know, as I said, if it was a case that we were withdrawing everything, you know, or they withdrew the file on, I don't know, you know, one particular gangster or whatever, Bugsy Malone or Bonnie and Clyde, and they also withdrew the files on John Lennon, and they withdrew the files on this person or that person, that I could understand. But to go after one specific area, that's kind of intriguing and suggests, you know, for some reason this is being done. You know, I don't believe it's coincidence. It can't be coincidence that UFO-related files, spontaneous combustion files, maverick scientist files with, you know, with, I guess, for want of a better term, you know, extraordinary views on science, radical ideas, etc., they're being withdrawn.
Well, in a certain sense, I can almost see in this terror-stricken era we're living in that the powers that be would think, okay, well, anything that could, you know, like Tesla, it's all technology. Mm. UFO reports, well, if you reverse engineer from the reports, if it gets you thinking about power sources and other ways of doing things. I mean, we're all familiar with the idea that there is a cover-up of this technology because it would totally topple the existing energy conglomerates and their power structures and their stranglehold on the fuel economies. But, you know, in some ways, I think it's like you said, mad scientist type stuff. But it also makes me think, you've again repeatedly said Fortean after Charles Fort. And I recall, you know, you've reported on and Greg's reported on how interested governments are in UFO people because of the information they're trading in often touches on secret stealth aircraft that haven't been revealed yet, and they're trying to track secrets and make sure that the wrong people aren't listening to them, you know, and protecting national security in a valid way. But I've seen documents from the FBI going back, I guess, to the 50s at least, or maybe even the 40s, where they refer to so-and-so as a Fortean in the report. Mm. And my point being that they've recognized those crazy people, Forteans, as somebody who trade in the kind of anomalous information that can be both mined for their own benefit, but can also be a worry for them in terms of, you know, what's this thing that's going to leak out?
Yeah, I mean, I don't doubt that that's a valid area of concern. You know, the idea that somebody looks into something and then they start getting innocent or so-called innocent inquiries from, you know, the Eastern Europe or whatever, somebody asking about the nature of their research.
Hmm.
And, you know, I'm quite sure that that happens. I'm sure that's a legitimate area of concern because, you know, we are a community that's looking for answers and somebody dangles the carrot. And, you know, maybe somebody unwittingly doesn't realize they're being used to get information for, you know, overseas intelligence services. I think that there's no doubt at all that's been a concern, you know, that's documented, that there's been this concern that UFO researchers could be used or have been used. You know, I think for me, the big puzzle in this particular breaking story is the fact that the material that's vanishing is so old. You know, if something had been released by accident from the 90s where, you know, the technology was still relevant or it was a breaking story, but, you know, some of these files on, for example, spontaneous combustion, they date from, I think it's 50 or 51. The Silas Newton file goes back to 48 and, you know, Tesla's goes back to when, you know, 1930s or something 30s, like that.
Yeah, and it's one of those, you would think if there had been anything of significance in there,
someone would have twigged to it already and said, oh, hey, look yeah. here, Tesla's anti-gravity engine is yeah. in the FBI files. you know,
yeah. And I mean, the other one that's also gone that I forgot to mention is the file on Jack Parsons.
That
one's gone as well. So.
A little bit closer, and, you know, one of those illustrations that...
mad scientists, again.
Yeah.
Very mad scientists.
For those who aren't familiar with Jack Parsons, he was involved in the early stages of what became JPL, Jet Propulsion Laboratories, and was intimately connected to, among other people, Aleister Crowley and L. Ron Hubbard. And this person was quite involved in Crowleyan magic, the Lima, various magical traditions, and trying to do big, big rituals.
But he was also, as Miles said, one of the founders of one of the foremost astronautical laboratories in the country, in the world. The Jet Propulsion Laboratory of California has sent spacecraft all over this system. Yeah. And he was basically our Wernher von Braun. He was our German rocket scientist. he was also practicing sex magic and summoning rituals. And one of the rumors surrounding his death is that, you know, he wasn't killed in a laboratory explosion, but actually attempting to harness some immensely powerful demonic force and failing.
Yeah. Yep.
So, you know, that's one of those, yeah, on the one hand, you have a very tangible result. On the other hand, you have something that, magic is the one thing that I am, unfortunately, rigidly skeptical about. Mm-hmm. But, yeah.
Well, it's certainly a whole show unto itself.
Gotta get Adam Garright, Leon.
Yeah, well, I mean, this idea of the intimate connection between the occult and the birth and continuance of the modern UFO era, a lot of people, especially Gorightly and others, are making those links. Mm-hmm. And you posted something, related to Fordianism and Crowley, UFO mystic.
With Crowley, you mean, or whatever?
Yeah,
I mean, it's a story I've been chasing down. I've got fragments of it about how in the 80s and 90s there were various people at the DOD that were very, very interested in researching the whole idea that, you know, the UFO subject was literally demonic. Now, you know, I've stressed to people this isn't my story that I'm researching. I'm researching basically the story of like a think tank group in the Pentagon, the DOD, that came to this conclusion and why they did, etc. And there's no doubt that some quite influential people who, you know, had high positions of responsibility in the military were actually of the opinion in the 80s and 90s that what crashed at Roswell was basically something invoked by Jack Parsons, because he was heavily involved with Robert Goddard. He's a good friend to Robert Goddard, who was based in Roswell doing rocket research.
Mm-hmm.
And I know the theory that they came up with 100% certainty is the idea that the thing that crashed at Roswell was like a Trojan horse, in the sense that it was a staged crash to make it look like friendly aliens had come down, when it was basically like a portal being opened to allow these, literally as the DOD, these DOD people believe them, to be soul-stealing demons. And the whole scenario they have is that Earth and our life here is kind of like the cows living on the farm, and then when we die, they farm our souls. And they believe that that is the truth behind the UFO mystery and why we can never be told.
That's straight out of Dr. Strangelove.
Yep, it is. And I mean, that's one of the things that I'm stressing to people is that, you know, this is coming from a government think tank that got together and pulled its views and ideas. And there's no doubt that a lot of the conclusions were based on belief systems of the people involved.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't, you know, as I've admitted to people, it wasn't the case that this group were all totally unbiased, coming into it having no knowledge, but then being tasked to find out the truth. Some of them were looking to get funding and set up a project that would, I guess, allow them to explore these deep suspicions that they had that this is what was going on. But that is the conclusion that they have, that, you know, there are no actual aliens, and that... we're just basically, you know, they farm, for want of a better term, the human life force after we die for their own energy.
And this, I've actually heard a variant of this expressed in many quarters that's not necessarily Christian fundamentalist.
No,
quarters.
It's not.
I recall abduction researcher Dr. Carla Turner. She, in an interview with Greg Bishop, she said that, you know, one night she and her husband stayed up and tried to put away all their biases and just look at the data as fresh as they could and try to think of what could accommodate what they had encountered the best. And the idea they came up with was that there had been a previous species on this planet that got advanced and was able to go non-corporeal, but because they were still physical in some sense, that they still required sustenance and that they were still tied to this world, and that they created us basically as cattle they would make just smart enough to manage themselves. And of course, Charles Fort. We are property. And he said worse than that, actually.
Also the theme of what's commonly called one of the first Fortean novels, something called Sinister Barrier by Eric Frank Russell, in which it's gradually discovered that invisible entities are basically hovering over us and, like you said, harvesting our life force at intervals. I can sort of understand where you could come to a conclusion like that, because abduction reports in terms of an advanced alien race looking to understand humanity make almost no sense. I mean, they're practicing essentially 19th century medicine with metal probes and straps. And, you know, you're supposedly talking about people who can cross interstellar space. And we already have the technology to basically completely scan the human body. You know, we do. But the Greys come across as, you know, kind of devilish little gnomes.
Well, and there's a great song by my local favorite band, Ed Hall, called Gnomes, that's all about this. But I suppose, Nick, you weren't encountering too many ufologists professing this particular belief system at the Crash Saucer Conference.
No. Now, the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference is one that Ryan Woods put on every year since 2003 in Las Vegas. It's a weekend conference, goes from Friday to Sunday every November. And basically, it's a conference that I guess unique in many respects, in the sense that it primarily, at least, just focuses upon aspects of the crashed UFO mystery rather than, you know, UFOs in general. So you generally get about three or four cases or lectures, I should say, of crash UFO stories. Maybe somebody will do a lecture on, you know, an alien autopsy account, somebody else on back engineering of a crashed UFO, things like this. So that they all have this sort of theme to them. And this year's was kind of a little bit of a departure because there were some lectures that did go off at a tangent, so to speak, and not to any massive extent, but certainly to, you know, open it up into other areas. For example, one of the lecturers there was a guy named Michael Schratt, who was speaking on, I guess, for in simplistic terms, what have become known as X-planes, you know, very, very futuristic advanced aircraft that are still on the secret list. And, you know, everybody, I'm sure, in the UFO subject has heard about things like the Aurora. But Schratt, as an aviation expert, I mean, he presented for the audience some really groundbreaking stories and illustrations and documents showing the really sheer extent to which the government and the military are test flying things that, you know, are truly radical, go far beyond flying wings and the, you know, the stealth type aircraft, just things that would defy explanation and description. Using very, very weird power systems that, you know, that have been test flown over Nevada. And, I mean, some of these things, you know, you would never even consider them to be anything other than a classic UFO if you were to see them.
Yeah, that's...
And I asked Schratt on the last night when we were going for dinner, I said, you know, is it possible in your mind, do you think that there could just be classified aircraft and nothing else? And he said, yeah, I actually do. He said, yeah, there are some strange reports, but it is possible that, you know, the truly unknown ones could all be, you know, just weird aircraft designs. And, I mean, he told a lot of stories of pilots, airline pilots, military pilots, who perhaps inadvertently strayed into other areas and, you know, had seen one of these things being test flown, and they'd been forced to land and were debriefed and warned not to talk about things they'd seen. And one pilot actually got so close to one of these prototype aircraft, he could see the other pilot in the aircraft. So he knew, you know, it wasn't like a little gray guy. It was sort of big, burly U.S. Air Force guy.
Yeah.
So his was an interesting lecture. And Matthew Williams, a friend of mine from Britain, he came over to speak about Gary McKinnon, the so-called UFO computer hacker.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He's being extradited here to the States to be tried.
Yeah, McKinnon's, I mean, he did something which I don't recommend anybody does. You know, he's very, very stupid. He basically hacked into countless U.S. Military and government and intelligence systems looking for classified UFO materials. And specifically, he hacked into NASA and claimed to have seen photographs showing weird objects in space and documents that had strange titles listing people like non-terrestrial officers. And Matthew came over and spoke about basically what Gary McKinnon did, why he did it, what prompted him to do it, and the situation that he faces now, which is he's still fighting extradition, and basically what he's also fighting is the idea, I suppose, of being tried under you know, national security / terrorism laws, which is, you know, far more serious than just getting your hands wrapped for, you know, messing around on the computer or whatever. And he quite literally does face, you know, sort of 70, 80 years the rest of his life in the equivalent of like Guantanamo. I mean, you know, people ask me about him. I think he was an idiot. I think he was just plain stupid to do this.
Yeah,
not just to do it, but to think he could even get away with it. But the one thing I will say is that I think, regardless of what he saw, what he didn't see, I do think that there's no doubt that he's going to be made an example of. And I think that, you know, he's going to have the book thrown at him if the Americans can you know, get to that position of having him brought over. They'll give him the most severe sentences possible to prevent or to dissuade others from following a similar path. So I think in some respect, yes, he was stupid to do it, but also he's going to be perceived, or he's going to be used as the fall guy for anybody else that might try this.
Right. I mean, there's another case that's very similar that predates it by 10 years or so, where there was not near as significant a reaction, but the difference being 9/11.
Yeah, this was a guy.
Demarcation date.
Yeah, the one you're probably talking about, a Welsh guy, Matthew Bevan.
Yeah, I think.
Yeah, well, Matthew was at the time a young kid when he did this, about 16 or 17, still living in his mom and dad's place, and he hacked into Wright-Patterson, looking for information on Roswell and crashed UFOs because he'd heard about these Hangar 18 stories. And actually, what's very interesting is that you don't get to hear about this too often, but he was basically arrested, actually a couple of years after he did the hacking, by Scotland Yard's Computer Crimes Unit. And apparently he was allowed to, in some respects, continue to snoop around because the authorities wanted to see if he was just doing it on his own, or if, you know, he was, when he logged off from the Wright-Patterson files, was he logging onto some server system in Russia or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he wasn't. He was just, you know, just a kid in his bedroom in his mom and dad's house in Wales. But when he was arrested, the police records show, one of the things that Scotland Yard were very interested in was the fact that when he hacked into Wright-Patterson, Bevan found information on anti-gravity research, you know, for want in simplistic terms, what's called anti-gravity research, and he actually found reference to a small prototype device that had been built that was like a split-level circular craft that operated on a super-heavy element, which is very, very similar to what Bob Lazar was talking about. Now, the fact is, however, that this was part of the interrogation on the part of Scotland Yard. You know, we're not talking about a bunch of UFO researchers asking the question, you know, is Bob Lazar just BSing us or whatever. You know, this is Scotland Yard asking the question. But what happened, the reason why Matthew Bevan's case collapsed was because, although this was brought up in the court case, and, you know, talking about this isn't a classified secret. It was actually discussed, as I said, in the court case, which was open to the media. The problem was not the fact that it was discussed, but when the judge said, okay, well, I want to see evidence that he went into these files and he read them and he damaged the systems as you're claiming he did, what happened was the American authorities said, sorry, we're not going to show you the evidence because it's classified. And the judge was like, well, you know, if this was a murder case and you're not going to present the body, how can I charge this guy with murder?
Mm-hmm.
Today, they're actually the new laws, post 9/11 laws, allow for a person to, well, as you know, to be basically taken away and interrogated with actually not being charged.
Yeah.
And they can be held indefinitely under these rulings. And that is what they're angling for with Gary McKinnon, is to find a way of preventing it from going to a mainstream trial where evidence would have to be presented, etc., but instead do it behind closed doors and where he could be held indefinitely and found, you know, guilty under those circumstances and where the evidence wouldn't be presented for one and all to see.
Now, it's my understanding he didn't actually print anything out.
No, that's the thing. He didn't do anything with the information. He didn't, you know, he didn't do anything with it because he couldn't. The file size was that huge. It took, you know, ages to download.
Oh, yeah, and he was supposedly on a dial-up modem too, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I think, you know, nobody disputes that he was stupid to do it and he shouldn't have done it. But, you know, by his own admission, he was just, you know, this pot-smoking UFO fanatic.
Really?
Yeah, real threat to national security. It was, you know, just doing something he shouldn't have done, took a very, very stupid action, and now finds himself, you know, basically in the same boat as somebody who's in Guantanamo.
Mm-hmm. Which is ridiculous in and
I mean, a lot of people, I was quite surprised. The audience at the conference, there are probably 300 people there. I would say 90% of them basically were of the opinion that if McKinnon should be punished, at least he should be able to serve his sentence in Britain and he should get like about 5 years probation or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe not even not allowed access to a computer for the next 5 years.
I seem to recall that within the last year he's had at least a minor victory on the extradition front.
Yeah, it's one of these things where, you know, he goes before the judge and both sides present their arguments, and so far he's resisted extradition. You know, whether that'll continue to be the case, I don't know. I mean, one of the things that Matthew pointed out in his lecture, which is kind of ironic, but it's also quite true, is the fact that had Scotland Yard simply arrested him, you know, maybe giving him a year's suspended sentence, fine him £1,000 or whatever, the story would have died the death. But the fact that, you know, here's this UFO computer hacker being extradited to the US, and all the time, you know, in the build-up to it, it's not like he's in jail, he's just at home, you know, and he's got all the national newspapers going to his house saying, what did you see, Gary, you know, tell us all about it, and he is, and they're publishing it.
Yeah.
So in some respects, by taking the high-handed approach, it backfires because it provides so much publicity for him and the newspapers to talk about it, and other people now are digging into, not in terms of hacking, but looking into trying to, you know, validate some of the things he said he saw. You know, for example, non-terrestrial officers, this particular phrase, people have been looking to try and determine what that means.
I have a vague notion that some of that stuff ties into the recent carrot phenomena, but I can tell by the rising music in the background that we're just about at the end of the hour.
Yeah, guys, it's been awesome talking to you, Nick. I know it's just the tip of the iceberg, but I think we really did get into the depth of a lot of this stuff. And of course, we've got to have you back on.
Okay.
And where can people find your stuff online?
Well, the best thing for them to do, if they go to my website, which is nickredfern.com, and if they go to the blog section on the right, that lists all the various blogs that I update pretty much most days. So rather than me try and tell you all the blog addresses, and of course they can get the books through the main website as well.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
Well, thanks again, Nick.
All right, thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
We'll talk to you soon.
Happy holidays.
Thanks, you too.
All right, everybody. Thanks for joining us. This is Anomaly Radio. You're listening to Precognitive Dissonance.
On Thursday night in Austin, I'm Craig York.
And Smiles Lewis saying good night.
Keep watching the skies. Excuse my language, but the ultra 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 ultra